Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on dead men's secrets when we come back. You know, once in a while, we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. Now, Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft. And someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there is no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it, and I know it. And what folly is this, toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes, he said. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program, this New World Order. It's the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers, the Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time that we wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and to survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, call and order my 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational. It's entertaining. It's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book called Dead Men's Secret. I rate this book at a 1 in 100. You won't see another book like this. At least I haven't, and I'm an old man. I have seen many of the stories contained in this book separately, one at a time, in various publications. But there are 969 records in this book that cover things like ancient technology in glasswork and microscopes, geography, astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, metallurgy, large-scale construction, construction techniques, social organization, engineering, mechanical devices, everyday items, clothing, art, medicine, flight, space travel, ancient science, civilization, electricity, weaponry, 969 records that are being systematically hidden, that are being systematically kept secret. And of course, the question arises, why? If you're an archaeologist and you're out digging around in the ruins and you come up with a battery, don't you think that you ought to put that on display and say, my God, the civilization had electricity? If you're digging around in the rubble and you pull up something that's metallic and you test it and you say, my God, these people had metallurgy. Don't you think we should put that on display in a museum and say, look at this. We were digging around in Babylon. We were digging around in Tyre or Sidon. We were digging around in Egypt, and look what we found. That would indicate that we had an advanced technology. Now, it would also do something politically. It would destroy the theory of evolution, which is a political ideology. It's a fairy tale for adults that we've all been subjected to, which has nothing to do with truth, honesty, or academics. It's a political ideology which is used to keep us enslaved mentally to ideas, political ideas and concepts that are absolutely false. So the author, a guy by the name of Jeffrey Gray, took a look at all of the various examples of these kinds of archaeological finds. And like medicine, you know, most of the medical discoveries are actually made by medical doctors. For instance, I've reported a number of times that we now have 13 cures for cancer. We use 3 out of the 13, cut, burn, and poison. We use those 3. It cures 37% of cancer patients. 63% die. Why don't we use the other 10 cancer cures? Well, it's because it's politically incorrect. You can't do that because of economic reasons. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons why we don't use alternative medical technology or knowledge today, and it basically has to do with follow the dollar. And the same thing is true with archaeology. In fact, the same thing is true with all of the sciences. If there's money to be made, then this is what we're going to do. The truth be damned. Now, as a researcher, as a historian, as a reporter, I like to trace stories back to their origins. And this is a whale of a story called Dead Men's Secrets. Now, I've reported from time to time the Nazca Plateau story. It's 30 square miles sitting up in the Andes Mountains, and on top of the mountains there are these little 18-inch high walls that go for miles and miles and miles. These are not big blocks of rock. These are just ordinary rocks, maybe the size of your head. And they're stacked up in such a way that they make little, you know, probably a foot wide wall, 18 inches high. But the crazy part is that they're in the outline and they're perfect. I mean, if you take a look at the head of a spider compared to his body, it's the right proportion. If you take a look at the length of his legs compared to his body and his head, they're the right proportions. And there's a spider up here on top of the Andes Mountains up in this Nazca Plateau. And I reported it to you last time. And the crazy part of it is it's a very rare spider found in the Amazon Basin. You don't find it in Germany or China, or the United States. It's a little spider, and it's found over in the Amazon Basin. Very rare spider. You don't run across these very often. This spider has a modality of reproduction, which you can't see. It's done with his third leg, and you can't see what he's doing without a microscope. And yet this spider, 6 miles long, 4 miles wide, is sitting up on top of this mountain. You can't even see this spider. You wouldn't know that it was a spider. It's just walls of rock until you get up in an airplane 1,000 feet above the ground, and then you can see, well, it's a spider. And the one over there is a monkey, and the one over there is something else. Now, first of all, you have to have airplanes to appreciate the artwork. Secondly, nobody can figure out why in the world anybody would make such artwork. And third, this rare spider over here with its reproductive technique is clearly outlined in the extended third leg, which ends in a void. So the artist, or the civilization, the people, the project manager, whoever it was, picked a spider, put this spider in rock, 4 by 6 miles, put him on top of a 12,000-foot mountain, and had to have had a microscope in order to have seen this reproductive technique, and then reproduce it in the form of the spider sitting here on the earth. Now, that's the story I told you last time, and that's an awesome story. There's 969 more of these stories in this book. That's why I said this is absolutely wild. It sounds like Buck Rogers science fiction, but it is supported by the actual documents, or the actual exhibits. Now, I'm on page 259, and I'm looking at chapter 25, which is entitled Electricity, Ruins That Glow in the Night. Electricity. Could there have been electricity in Solomon's day, or in Abraham's day, or in Noah's day, or in the period between Adam and Eve and the flood? And the answer is an absolute and unqualified yes. There are batteries that have been dug up in Baghdad and put in the British Museum of Natural History in London. The first ones were found in 1885 before they even know what the hell a battery was. So the original archaeologists, when they're digging these artifacts up, dug up batteries, couldn't recognize them because they'd never seen one before. So they stuck it in the museum. Then about the 1950s, somebody's poking around in the warehouse and says, "Oh my God, look at this. This is a battery. Where did this come from?" Well, it came from some archaeological dig that Professor So-and-so did back in 1885. Now, you'd think that they would take that artifact and they'd say, "Oh my God, these people had electricity back here in ancient times." Oh no, that doesn't fit the theory of evolution. Back in ancient times, men were just emerging, you know, from the Dark Ages. And so because of that, because of this theory of evolution, they buried it. It's in a warehouse. It sits there. It's photographed. And the photographs are here in the book. So it isn't something that's science fiction. It isn't something that's a lie. It's there, but it isn't being reported. And I'm here to ask the question, why not? Why not report the facts? Why not report the truth? If it doesn't fit with our theory, then I guess we have to change our theory. That's the scientific way. It's the scientific principle. Well, now, it may sound astonishing, but it was true. On a trek through the forbidding Mato Grosso region of Brazil in 1925, Colonel P.H. Fawcett was challenged by native reports of mysterious cold lights in some ruined cities of the jungle. Not only that, there existed, it was claimed, a city still living, inhabited, illuminated at night. Could this really be? Might there be some still surviving remnant of a long-lost civilization which was using forgotten knowledge? So Fawcett came out averring that he had glimpsed one of these jungle cities. He re-entered the region to further pursue his passion, but this time he disappeared without a trace. And it's noteworthy that few have ever set foot in this terra prohibita and then returned. It's a lost world. Indeed, it is a land infested with enormous swamp creatures, wild beasts, and wilder men. This region is generally bounded by the Rio Xingu and the Rio Tapajos, that's Tapajos, and the Amazon rivers. In regard to the supposed jungle lights, I'm somewhat intrigued. The existence of devices which provided lightning at night in ancient times cannot be questioned, because so many classical writers have described them. I was dumbfounded to discover this. Until 1890, we, in modern times, possessed only candles, torches, and oil lamps. And it is easy to think that this was always the case. However, we must now regard the past use of lightning and electricity as a historical certainty. In the pre-flood era, electricity may have played a vital role in the operation of the Ark of Noah during the Great Flood. Referring to the Ark, two Hebrew words are translated as window in the English Bible. In one reference, in Genesis 8, verse 6, the Hebrew word chalon, C-H-A-L-L-O-N, meaning opening, is used, the window through which Noah released the bird. The outer or the other reference, Genesis 6, verse 16, uses a different word. It's spelled T-S-O-H-A-R, Sohar, which is translated as window, but does not mean window or opening at all. Where it is used 22 times in the Old Testament, its meaning is given as a brightness, a brilliance, a light of the noonday sun, referring to something that glistens, glitters, or shines, or a light which has its origins in a shining crystal, according to many Jewish scholars of the traditional school. Now, for centuries, Hebrew tradition has described the Sohar as an enormous gem or pearl hung in the ark, which, by some power within itself, illuminated the entire vessel. Now we come to the Sumerian legends. In the preparation of the huge boat, Utu, Methuselah, brought his rays of the sun into the boat in order to give it light. In California, again, regarding that device resembling a spark plug found inside sedimentary stone, examination showed an outer hexagon layer of an unknown substance enveloping a 3/4-inch wide cylinder made of solid porcelain or ceramic. Circling the ceramic cylinder were rings of copper. In the center of the cylinder was a 2-millimeter shaft of bright metal. The shaft was magnetic. The magnetic shaft was corroded at one end, but the other end was affixed to a spring or helix of metal. The finely shaped ceramic and metallic shaft and copper components hint at some form of electrical instrument. This find, like so many others, is not generally publicized. It is considered too disturbing. In India, a high tower over a tomb discharged lightning against anyone who approached, striking them dead. Israel, 1000 BC, the house of Solomon the king was illuminated as by day, for in his wisdom he had made shining pearls, which were like unto the sun, the moon, and the stars in the roof of his house. In France, electrical knowledge was preserved by the secret Hebrew society called the Kabbalah, a dazzling lamp that lighted itself with no oil or wick, a door knocker that shocked unwelcome visitors, a Jewish rabbi named Jekeli, spelled J-E-C-H-I-E-L-E, pushed a discharge button in his study that sent an electrical current into the iron knocker on his door. In Egypt, a wall carving depicts a scene where attendants seem to be carrying giant light bulbs with interior filaments in the shape of snakes connected to a box or switch with braided cables, and which strongly suggest powerful electric lamps supported by high-tension insulators. The cables are an exact copy of engineering illustrations as currently used. The cable is shown as very heavy and striated, S-T-R-I-A-T-E-D, striated, indicating a bundle of many multi-purpose conductors rather than a single high-voltage cable. In Egypt, in an Isle temple, Isis temple, a lamp burned with neither wind nor water, and which neither wind nor water could extinguish. Until the invention of electric lighting in 1890, we possessed only candles, torches, and oil lamps, light sources which smoked and left sooty deposits on ceilings. Likewise, the Greek and Roman world used torches and oil lamps for illumination. And wherever passageways are still standing between ancient buildings, traces of smoke can be found on the ceilings. How then do we explain the following? In Egypt, no trace of smoke is found in any Egyptian pyramid or in the subterranean tombs of the pharaohs, which are beautifully carved and painted in several colors. Work of this precision and delicacy requires the equivalent of daylight. Some tunnels and passageways are too complex for a mirror system to have brought sufficient light into the inner chambers. In Western Europe, the walls and ceilings of certain painting caves show no traces of torches or of oil lamps. In Peru, low ceilings and passageways of Inca and pre-Inca ruins show no evidence of smoke blackening. In Brazil, explorer Fawcett found ancient dwellings and dead cities of the Mato Grosso devoid of lamp smoke. In Egypt, Babylon, as early as 2000 BC, Central Australia, China, and Bulgaria, as early as 3000 BC, electroplated objects have been found, indicating the use of electricity. Now, that's an important one. It's important because electroplating is something that's recent. That's where we have a process that we can take gold, for instance, and we can plate that gold onto, say, a silver fork, or we can plate it onto some other object, and we can make it appear like the object is gold or silver by electroplating. Now, when you go into the archaeological digs and you pull an object out of King Tut's tomb and it's been electroplated, when you go into Egypt, Babylon, Central Asia, China, and Bulgaria, and we're not just talking about one isolated civilization like Egypt, and gee, look how smart they were. They not only had it in Egypt, they had it in Babylon, they had it in Central Australia, they had it in China, and they had it in Europe. Electroplating was known all over the world. Now, I don't know that we know that it's there in North and South America, but it's on every other continent. Now, that's quite a find. Why isn't that being put? Why aren't those objects being put on display in our museums? Why aren't we being told about that in our colleges and universities? That's a pretty significant find. Now, up until this particular item, this is number 12, in this section here on electricity, you know, you could sit there and say, well, you know, there's no smoke found in any Egyptian pyramid. That doesn't mean they had electricity. Let's think about that for a second. You get here into these pyramids, and it's hundreds of feet of tunnels that you have to go through in order to get into this tomb. You get into the tomb, and here is very fine, delicate artwork. You know, not something that somebody just pasted on the wall. It's a stick figure, you know, that somebody painted on there. This is something that's very, very intricate in painting. In fact, there's a section in here called art. I'll cover that one next on page 239. And this art thing over here, and I'm not an artist, so I didn't know this, but this art over here, you can actually grade this. You can determine how advanced a civilization is by looking at their art. And the artwork that we find in these ancient pyramids, in these ancient ruins, is superior to anything until the Middle Ages. And I'll read that story to you when we get to it. But I wanted to cover this electricity because I think electricity is pretty fundamental. Now, from the time Ben Franklin discovered electricity by flying his famous kite with a key on it in a thunderstorm until we had electric lights in 1890 was about 100 years. You know, from about 1790 to 1890, about 100 years, we developed electric lights. You know, Ben Franklin wasn't technologically advanced in electricity or electronics, but in 100 years. Watch what happens. 100 years later, we've got computers in 1990. Now, these people before the flood were living to be 900 years old. Now, picture a civilization in which people don't die, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, when I develop my knowledge, I have to write that down. My entire working career started at about age 30. You know, from age 0 to age 30, I didn't accomplish anything in life. I'd never written a book. I'd never written anything down of any consequence. Maybe a couple of love letters to my girlfriend. That was about the extent of my writing career. From age 30 until age 65, I have written, I couldn't count the number of books that I've written. I probably have 50 or 75 books. I wrote a lot of material. I write on legal subjects, and I have a lot of written material here. I teach school. I write most of the material that goes into my textbooks. Now, I'm going to die here pretty shortly. You know, certainly within the next 30 years, I'm going to be history. I'm going to be dead and buried. My entire working career, everything that I have learned, everything that I have written down and preserved for the next generation had to have been done in about 40 working years. Can you imagine what I could accomplish if I could live to be 300 years old? Can you imagine how much I would write, how much I would know, how much I could disseminate to the next generation if I had 300 years to do what I've done over the past 40? So, it doesn't strike me as being preposterous that people before the flood had developed electricity and electric light bulbs. Hell, we did it in the last 200. Adam didn't even have children until he was 130. The guy lives to be, you know, 930 years old. He could have done it by himself. All right. Furthermore, it's been reported that those people before the flood were smarter than we are today. Their IQs were better. I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I wouldn't doubt it. We're digging up now in archaeological digs, we're digging up the evidence that they had electroplating, for crying out loud. That's pretty significant metallurgy. And the Bible reports that they were artificers in brass and iron in Genesis chapter 4. Now, people that are artificers in brass and iron are advanced. They're ahead of casting cannon in sand, which is where we were with Columbus in 1500. So from 1500 to 2000, we had made gigantic strides in metallurgy. We were making railroad rails, building iron ships by 1900. Now look where we're at. We have aluminum, titanium, all kinds of metal and metallurgy that now make our modern technology possible, such as computers. Now, there's an electric battery from ancient Babylon. There's a diagram here by Andrew Thomas, and it's in the form of a clay pot with an electrode down through the bottom, which holds the acid inside, with an iron rod, copper cylinder, earthenware jar, copper disc, wire out the top, with a pitch collar, and an unknown electrolyte. That's what they dug out back in the 1880s, and then took it back to the British Museum. Didn't know what they had. You know, you dig something out of the ground, and you say, well, I don't know what this is. It almost reminds me of the medical scientists, you know. They take a look at human anatomy 100 years ago and say, well, these are vestigial organs. We don't know what a tonsil or an adenoid or an appendix does in the body, so therefore, because of our theory of evolution, we believe that these are vestigial organs. And so when I was a kid, they used to cut people's tonsils and adenoids out. I don't know how I survived it. I guess it was my old granny, who used to say, if God had intended, then he would have done. That was her old her mantra. If God had intended that, he would have done it. If God had intended that your adenoids and your tonsils be removed, he wouldn't have made you with them. That was her thinking in life. And so I survived through the World War II period with my tonsils and adenoids. It was just common. You know, you had tonsils and adenoids, you go to the doctor and they remove them. Every kid in school had his tonsils and adenoids removed. Now we find out it's a part of your immune system. One doctor reported he had never seen a case of cancer in a person who had tonsils and adenoids. It's a part of your immune system, kids. Now, we routinely went through our population and removed everybody's tonsils and adenoids. We have the highest incidence of cancer in the world. I just thought I'd pass that one on to you. All right, so there's the story on electricity. Now, just to give you an illustration here, let me find electricity. There are 66 stories on electricity. There are 969 records. 66 of those records are on archaeological finds around the world dealing with electricity in this book, which is called Dead Men's Secrets by Jonathan Gray. If you want a copy, you can get a copy, I'm sure. In fact, I know you can from BraveNewBookstore.com. So if you're online, go to BraveNewBookstore.com or Brave New Bookstore. Their phone number is 512-480-2503. I don't get paid for promoting them. The reason that I use them so much on the air is because many of these books are hard to find. You know, people will call the law school and say, well, I can't find that book. Can't find that book. All right, well, now you can find it. That's where you go to get it. I'm sure this is a book published in 2004. I'm sure you can get it at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or your local bookstore. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, secular, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. But I think they should. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I said we take a look at art, so I whip over here to page 239. This was quite a story on art. I didn't know this. But art, you can take a look at it and you can see how advanced people are. Imagine, and you may say, and perhaps I should agree, were it not for the consistent testimony of reputable witnesses. Well, a crystal skull during certain phases of the moon emits cappella choir music, melodious tinkling bells, and a violet glow. Scientists have no theory at all to explain this phenomenon. The 11-pound skull was unearthed by Michael Hedges at Lubuntan, British Honduras. Now, this is spelled L-U-B-A-A-N-T-U-N. Lubuntan, British Honduras. It is no secret that prehistoric art and sculpture pose for us some tantalizing mysteries. We are confronted with three-dimensional art, four-dimensional art, visible then invisible, sex change sculpture, 18-story high statues, murals in luminous paint, carvings designed to produce a 15-minute moving picture, a sequence with the brilliance of a neon sign. Did you get that? Listen to this again. Here's what we have dug up in archaeological digs. Three-dimensional art. Four-dimensional art. Visible, then invisible. Holograms, we call those today. Sex change sculpture. 18-story high statues. Murals in luminous paint. Did you get that one? Murals in luminous paint. Where in the hell do these people get luminous paint? Carvings designed to produce a 15-minute moving picture, a sequence with the brilliance of a neon sign. Now, such subtle techniques run counter to the common view of primitives living in caves, using clubs and crude flint tools, and looking like ape men. So far, I have not been fortunate enough to hear an explanation of such ultra-modern genius that is even tolerably convincing. Some of this art is so advanced, its techniques are ahead of our time today. In Altamara, Spain, Lascaux, France, that's spelled L-A-S-C-A-U-X, I guess that's Lascaux, France, and then Riba de Silla, spelled R-I-B-A-D-A-S-E-L-L-A, in the Sahara Desert. There are cave paintings of highly developed and stylized art, which look strangely modern, masterpieces in any period. Their dynamic realism and beauty, their flowing lines and contrast, their use of perspective, make them immensely superior to the later animal paintings of Egypt, Babylon, Greece, or Crete, and of a level not again reached until the Renaissance in the 15th century. Sketches and trial pieces found suggest that there were art schools. The pictures show shadows and highlights. There is a plan of construction, an idea of composition that makes use of hollows and knobs in the rock. The painters possessed a culture much more advanced than the average inhabitant of the European countryside today. Now, Ajanta, spelled A-J-A-N-T-A, near Bombay, India, in the 6th century. Luminous paints, cave murals, portraying women carrying gifts, lack depth until the light is switched off. In darkness, the figures on the wall appear to be three-dimensional, as if they were made of marble. By the clever employment of luminous paint, the secret of which has been lost forever. Can't be duplicated today, or at least nobody knows how. France. The engraved bones of Glazel are still the finest in the world. From Mohenjo-Daro, Pakistan, Mesopotamia, and the Persian Gulf, in case you want to check me out. This is spelled M-O-H-E-N-J-O hyphen J, excuse me, D-A-R-O, Pakistan. Soapstone seals, carved with figures of bulls, elephants, antelope, and other animals. One showing a man up a tree with a tiger lurking hungrily below, are only as big as postage stamps. So fine is the artwork that it might have been done under a magnifying glass. Here's miniature art. In Havia, Brazil, spelled H-A-V-E-A, Brazil, a mountain carved to resemble the head of a bearded man wearing a spiked helmet. On the side of the mountain, on a small vertical face, 3,000 feet in height, is a carved inscription in cuneiform characters, some 10 feet tall. It is a mystery as to how this was accomplished. In the plateau of Marchuasi, M-A-R-C-A-H-U-A-S-I, in Peru, is a plateau called Marcahusi, Peru. Four-dimensional art. Carvings which, according to the angle of vision, have several faces, but you have to move into the right spot to distinguish each of them. As you move, they disappear or change into other figures. Many become visible, then invisible again, seen only at noon or twilight, or certain other hours, or at one of the solstices, and at no other time. A figure of an old man, when photographed, changes into the carved face of a radiant youth. Now, how can we explain this sculptural mystery, which is revealed only in the photograph? It is hard to see how an artist could achieve this effect, even with the benefits of modern science, without a photograph to work from. Now, think of that. I'm going to read that one to you again. There's a place down in Peru. There's a plateau there. You spell it M-A-R-C-A-H-U-A-S-I, that has a four-dimensional artwork. This four-dimensional artwork is made up of carvings which, according to the angle of vision... Now, think about this. Here in modern times, we have what we call holograms. And when you turn the page, it gives you a different picture. So you can look at it in two-dimension, three-dimension, and the hologram makes four-dimension. That's pretty modern. That's pretty modern. I didn't know about holograms when I was a kid. That's a technique that has been discovered here in the last, I don't know, 25 years maybe. Maybe somebody invented it in 1936, but it certainly wasn't very common. I don't know when it came about. Now, here's a carving which, according to the angle of vision, have several faces. But you have to move into the right spot to distinguish each of them. So it's not just a hologram on a page. This is an artwork that is on the side of a mountain. As you move, they disappear or change into other figures. This is a huge hologram. Many become visible and then invisible again. Some are seen only at noon or at twilight or certain other hours or at one of the solstices and at no other time. This thing is designed so that the rays of the sun at the solstices, the light angle that comes onto the face of this, can only be seen during the solstice. A figure of an old man, when photographed, changes into the carved face of a radiant youth. So in order to get the full dimension now of this piece of artwork, which is engraved on this, in rock, on this mountainside, you have to photograph it. And then look at the photograph to see the hologram change between what's on the mountain and what is hidden when you move it in different directions. I never heard of such a thing. And yet there it is. That isn't something that's been made by modern technology. That's something that can't be duplicated today. So far from dragging their knuckles on the ground, whoever these people were, you know, back in the olden days, how old were these olden days? Is this something done before the flood and survived the flood on the side of the mountain? Or is it something that was carried through the flood and developed after Noah's departure from the ark and the antediluvian races, survivors of the antediluvian races? See, I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure anybody else does. My thinking has always been that these things were done before the flood. This author here thinks that they were accomplished after the flood. All right, now the artist needed incomparable skill to make the shapes appear only from certain angles and under certain specific conditions of sunlight. These examples belong to a vast complex of monuments and sculptures covering a square mile, using whole cliffs with images of the four main human races and of animals from other parts of the world. Animals that are not found in South America today or in Peru. Races of people that are not found in North and South America are depicted on these carvings, and it covers a square mile of the cliffs. I mean, we're talking about something humongous here. Now, every type of sculptural technique was used. Bas relief, engraving, and play of light and shade. The sculptors scientifically utilized the laws of perspective and optics. Then there's Easter Island, South America, the Onega River in Russia, the Maya Guatemalans, and in Australia. Now down in Australia, this is number 10. Remember the picture that we get coming out of Australia, or the people that live there, are these Aborigines. Just dumb as rocks. And I'm not sitting here saying that the Aborigines did this kind of artwork or that they knew anything about this, because the modern Aborigines today don't seem to have very much in the way of technology. These are Stone Age people. But boys and girls, we have Stone Age people while we're flying to the moon. Stone Age people live on every continent, except maybe for Europe and Antarctica. You know, we got Eskimos up in North America, and we've got Aboriginal people that are living in the Amazon Basin. We got Aborigines living in Australia, nomads walking around in the Gobi Desert. I mean, you know, there's people all over the world that are still living in the Stone Age in New Guinea, for crying out loud. Now, down in Australia are these laser beam carvings. Laser beam carvings. Punchings of designs and symmetrical forms have been made 4 to 8 inches deep on rock faces 30 to 300 feet up in the air. Now, attempts to duplicate these engravings with modern tools failed. The rock would only chip or flake. Nothing but a laser beam could have left this impression in this rock. That's the claim of one scientist, with a footnote number 2. Not forgetting that in the United States of America, Apache Indians spoke of tunnels carved out by rays that destroy the living rock. Apache Indians spoke of tunnels carved out by rays that destroy the rock. Now, that's art and artwork. Now, there's a lot of it, and I can cover much more of it here, but there are, looking at art here now for a second, there are 15 examples of art like this that have been discovered around the world. It's in Africa, China. You know, let me give you some places that this has been found. The Mayas in Guatemala. It's in British Honduras and Mexico. It's in Guyana, England, the USA, Chile, Afghanistan, Peru, Egypt, Germany, Russia, Australia, the Plateau of Peru, Easter Island, South America, England, France, the Onega River in Russia, Pakistan, Mesopotamia, the Persian Gulf, Brazil, Spain, France, in the Sahara Desert. Boys and girls, this kind of art, some of it, which has just been discovered in the last 50 years or less. And this one here that I just read to you, the rock can't be worked by hand. It has to be worked with lasers because it's too brittle and the rock just flakes off. Can't be polished except by laser. And yet there it is. Here's the artwork that's sitting up there. Now, we've only discovered lasers here in the last 50 years or so. When I was a kid, you know, I heard of Buck Rogers ray beams. And then later on, we came up with a thing called laser beams. And now they're working with these lasers to use them, you know, in weaponry so they can kill people with them. You know, there's anything that we discover out here that we can't adapt to killing people with. All right, so there's the story on art. Let's back up here a little bit, or go ahead a little bit here. Take a look at medicine, maybe, on page 245. Health and medical. What happened after the car crash? Well, following a serious car accident in 1963, the victim's life was saved in a most unusual manner. For the delicate operation, Peruvian surgeon Francisco Grano used surgical instruments that had been exhumed from a 3,000-year-old tomb. They were manufactured from an alloy of gold, copper, and silver. Ancient medical practice, it appears, was more than just folk herbs. Rather, medicine and surgery were fantastically advanced millennia ago. A sophisticated medical science existed worldwide, and in some cases is only now being relearned by modern research. We shall never know anything, but can only wonder at the profusion of medical knowledge and skill that prevailed at the dawn of history. Now, the following are fragments of that knowledge. Now, you probably have heard or seen, I've read about this in Reader's Digest and others, where they have dug up skulls, especially in Peru and Ecuador, that had surgery done on the brain, in the cranium. They can tell that because if you bore into somebody's brain, then the body is living. If it heals over, then the guy survived the surgery. Many skulls have been unearthed that had holes drilled into the brain and the cranium and then healed over, indicating the surgery, the brain surgery, was successful. And of course, that's one of those mysteries that, you know, you publish or you see in some magazine or something, but it's by itself. It isn't put together like chapter 24 is in Dead Men's Secrets, where there are 87 examples of this, and not just in Peru. It occurs in India, Egypt, China. It's mentioned in the Bible. In Bolivia, Peru, Britain, and again in, I'll find some different countries, Greece, Egypt, Crete, Australia, Samaria, Armenia, Guatemala, Peru, Pompeii, Italy, Jericho in Israel, Italy. Now, many of these examples are repeated, so I'm not repeating India, China. There's Mexico. All right, so it's worldwide. It's in China. It's in Egypt. It's in South America. I don't see any here in North America. Here's Spain, Palestine, Assyria, Canary Islands, skull operations. Here are skull operations that have been dug up and documented in Egypt, Peru, Soviet Armenia, Central Russia, Polynesia, Peru, Canary Islands, India, Bolivia, Samaria, dentistry. Dentistry identified in Missouri in the USA 3,000 years ago, Egypt, Guatemala, Peru, Lebanon, Arizona, Italy. So we've got dentistry. We've got skull operations. What else have we got here? Surgical instruments have been dug up in Pompeii, Italy, Crete, Peru, Jericho in Israel, Italy, India, Egypt, Armenia, Guatemala. What else have we got? Surgical instruments. Health and medicine. A college of surgeons, a faculty of medicine, pharmacologists, specialist doctors, veterinarians, a state-sponsored medical aid program in which doctors received their remuneration from the government, and medical aid was free to all. This was found in Peru and Egypt, China, Alexandria, Egypt, Bolivia. Quarantine is revealed in the Bible. It is significant that the deadly European plagues of the Dark Ages were brought under control by the following of quarantine rules and other rules laid down in the biblical writings of the book of Leviticus. With medicine at such a low point during this period, Jewish doctors were highly esteemed. Has the thought crossed your mind that there might be something more behind this source of information than meets the eye? All right, so now we've covered art and medicine in this series. We have to take a break here because I'm just about out of time. And we'll come back and we'll take a look at more on geography, astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, metallurgy, large-scale and construction techniques. I covered those in earlier broadcasts. Engineering. Mechanical devices. I think the next time we'll take a look at some of these mechanical devices and everyday items that have been dug up all over the world that we didn't have 100 years ago, but they had thousands of years ago. How did that happen? Next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Meanwhile, you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.